Hey, hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix. And before we get into this very interesting conversation with Phil Geiger, I want to tell you about our amazing sponsors. The only way to truly own your Bitcoin is to get your BTC off your exchange and into a hardware wallet that you control. I hope the situation with the truckers in Canada is shedding light on the importance of self-custody. Now make sure that you secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure with a CipherGrid seed storage device. It's the best value in the industry because you get everything you need for $59. Two brass plates for all 24 seed words, not just one plate for 12 words. This seed storage device has privacy by default and has been fire tested up to 1700 degrees. It's BIP39 compatible. It can be locked with a padlock. There's a tamper evidence seal provided and an automatic center punch provided. Just like all CipherSafe products, it's fireproof, rustproof, and waterproof. To keep your sats safe, go to ciphersafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. Ledin is pleased to announce that starting on February 1st, annual interest on newly opened Ledin loans will be decreasing to 8.9%. This is an improvement on their cost of capital, which is allowing them to reduce your cost of financing your Bitcoin. You can take advantage of these improved terms today by accessing some dollar liquidity with a dollar loan, or you can increase your Bitcoin holdings with a B2X loan to make the most of the recent dip. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix get $50 in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. To learn more, sign up at start.ledn.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Between working from home, mandates, and lockdowns, you might be thinking about adding an extra room at the house or renting a place to escape or retreat from encroaching communism. I know I am. Citadel Cabins is in the custom building industry, and they are famous for small log cabins that can be shipped anywhere and easily assembled by you and a couple of friends in just a few days without any specialized skills or power tools required. Imagine adding a room to your house or dropping a cabin in the woods. As we descend deeper and deeper into clown world, these cabins are creating a way for families to escape and establish KYC-free location sovereignty, surrounded by people who care about freedom as much as we do. Or maybe you want to get off the grid completely. Citadel Cabins is a Bitcoin-only company that exists to help individuals achieve shelter, rest, security, and location independence. Head over to citadelcabins.com for more information and to fill out an application now. Bitcoin 2022 is the largest Bitcoin event in the world that takes place April 6th to 9th in Miami Beach, Florida. All 4 days will be jam-packed with exclusive content, exciting announcements, and an incredible lineup of Bitcoin speakers. Day one is industry day for enterprising Bitcoiners who are looking to build a career or business within the ecosystem. Days two and three are general conference days featuring speakers like El Salvadorian President Nayib Bukele, who has promised a big surprise, as well as CEOs like Michael Saylor, Elizabeth Stark, Jack Mahlers, Adam Back, and more. The conference caps off on the fourth day with the world's largest and first Bitcoin music festival, the Sound Money Fest, headlined by rapper and fellow Bitcoiner Logic, Steve Aoki, Run the Jewels, San Holo, Deadmau5, and many more. This year is on pace to be 3 times larger than last year's, so make sure to grab your tickets before it's too late. Visit b.tc/conference to learn more. Ticket prices increase on February 18th, so make sure to use the promo code BitcoinMatrix for 10% off, and I will see you in Miami. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Phil Geiger for this fascinating and insightful conversation on how all 21 million Bitcoin already exist, already have, always have, and why 21 million is non-negotiable.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Phil Geiger is the managing director of Concierge Services, helping you forge diamond hands at OnChain Capital, and the author of All 21 Million Bitcoin Already Exist and 21 million Bitcoin is Non-Negotiable. Phil has said that Bitcoin is the strongest currency the world has ever seen. It's global, neutral, and can't be arbitrarily debased by a central authority. Because it is designed to store value for the long run, Bitcoin incentivizes people to save rather than consume. There's nothing better for the environment than a single neutral global currency that makes overconsumption more expensive. And he wants us to build the Dyson Sphere to mine Bitcoin. Phil Geiger, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. This has been in the works for probably over a year now, getting together to chat. And well, congratulations.
Yeah, we've gone back and forth a few times.
Yeah, congratulations on fatherhood. I'm super excited for you.
Thank you.
And you know, in that time, I've gotten to really dig into your work. You've published articles back to, you know, at least 2019 that we're going to focus on tonight. But I'd like to get to know a little bit about you and on-chain capital. And how did you even get into Bitcoin?
Sure. And if you do some digging, you might find some articles that I published way back in about 2016. So I've been in Bitcoin for quite a while at this point. But I started learning about it because really I was just at the, you know, in the right place at the right time. I had a background in Keynesian economics, got a degree from a private university in models and graphs that don't really, you know, relate to reality all that well. So pivoted after school, went into software implementation where I was traveling around the world, configuring healthcare software. Hmm. And I happened to be in Madison, Wisconsin at the end of 2014. And I was at an event at a bar called Nerd Night, which is somewhat like a TED Talk, very informal TED Talk at a bar. And a bunch of grad students were going up and giving presentations about all different topics. And one woman went up and presented the history of money, starting with the Isle of Yap and, you know, moving all the way to Bitcoin. And I just, again, was kind of in the right place at the right time. Enough of the pieces clicked. My background of economics and with software just made things gel for me. And maybe just having an open mind led me down the rabbit hole. So within a week or so of that, I ended up getting Bitcoin and, of course, was reading all about the other cryptocurrencies at the time. So bought some stinkers and realized pretty quickly after that, you know, after I started digging into what I had just purchased and started reading Austrian economics, I realized that Bitcoin is the innovation and the rest of the field is noise. It's churn. It's what happens when money has been disrupted at a fundamental and global level.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about when you started reading Austrian economics. And at this point, I mean, you were obviously interested in economics before Bitcoin, but maybe Keynesian economics. And what were you thinking? Were you reading this for fun? Were you reading this to gain conviction in Bitcoin? Do you just enjoy economics?
Well, I actually didn't enjoy economics all that much, even though I did get a degree in it. I just kind of fell into the major in some ways. But what I didn't like about the degree I received is that I didn't think that it really described reality all that well. There was a lot of models, there was a lot of assumptions, and it didn't feel right. It didn't feel like it made sense and was descriptive of the world around me. Once I found Bitcoin, it led me a little bit down the Austrian side of economics, and that really clicked for me. And I realized, oh no, I actually do really like economics. I just like economics that's built on sound assumptions and sound logic and make sense for me individually. And Austrian economics is really built on truths that you can just check for yourself. Like, is, you know, X true? Yes. Then, you know, Y and Z might happen, or, you know, so on and so forth. So I started reading some Austrian economics after discovering Bitcoin and learning, oh, Bitcoin is really, it's described well by Austrian economics, and read the Bitcoin Standard when that came out. I read Mises, so Human Action was probably my biggest reading achievement. Was getting through that book. It took me, you know, 7 or 8 months, but I read the whole thing. Dabbled in some Hayek, some Rothbard. Read, you know, Holzman, Ethics of Money Production. And a few others as well. So that's really what I do now when I have some free time is pick up an Austrian economics book when I'm not reading Bitcoin books. And yeah, I really like that because I just think it does a better job of describing my view of reality. And yeah, it's also helpful for my job, of course. What I didn't cover in my introduction was how I got connected with Unchained Capital. So I learned about Bitcoin in 2014 and then was living in Europe for a few years, quit my old job during the 2017 bull run. And after I moved back to the US in 2018, was listening to podcasts, heard Parker Lewis speak, just messaged him on Twitter, got on the phone, and the rest is history. So yeah, I've been working professionally in Bitcoin since about 2017. And even before I left my previous job, I was blogging about it. So some of my older articles are pretty silly, but it was just me kind of getting down some thoughts quickly and then hoping that other people would find them interesting.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, I guess, history, what has been, how did you fall into working? What was your sort of, I guess you were listening to podcasts with Parker and you reached out to him. What did you start doing with Unchained? And what is Unchained? What was it like then? And what is Unchained doing now?
Sure. So Unchained in 2018 was I joined Unchained in 2019, May of 2019. So it was a few months after they released their Vault product, which helps our clients to hold private keys. So we'll teach our clients how to set up hardware wallets, how to construct multi-signature addresses where they have 2 out of 3 keys. So they're in full control of their funds, but we're at Unchained, we're there as a partner. So if something goes wrong or if you forget, or lose a PIN, something like that, we can step in and use our key to help you recover. So I joined Unchained about 2 or 3 months after the Vault product launched, and I was brought on for product marketing. So I was brought on as the director of product marketing. And part of my role there was writing articles. Part of my role was really getting out there and trying to market the vaults. And maybe somewhat due to the success of my marketing skills, or maybe it was just pure kind of elbow grease, I realized that I was pretty effective at, helping people actually get set up with holding their own keys and getting on phone calls and interacting one-on-one with clients. So in June of 2020, I launched the concierge program. And that's where, our clients get one-on-one guidance with a very experienced Bitcoiner, walk them through setting up any of the hardware wallets we support. So any model of Trezor, Gold Card, Ledger, we'll go from A to Z and get them all set up with multi-sig. So I kind of found just through experience and being in Bitcoin for a while, that there was a definitely demand in the market for people to work with a guide, essentially, and just walk you through the steps and make sure you're not stepping on any landmines, because as we all know, there's many things that can go wrong in Bitcoin if it's not set up correctly. We don't want any Bitcoin lost, any more Bitcoin. There's been plenty of Bitcoin lost throughout its history.
Yeah, forging strong hands. Forging diamond hands. I'm a fan of multi-sig technology and the approach. All this is evolving, but I really do like that style. And I got to see Parker Lewis at Chicago BitDevs the other night. And awesome. I am a client of Unchained. And I'd like to talk a little bit about key storage principles before we get a little bit more into what Unchained does beyond just storage. But let's say, you're in the 2 out of 3 program. And you possess 2 keys. We've gone through implementation, orientation, whatever you want to call it. We've set the 2 keys up. We now have, and we're going to get a little bit into misnomers and vernacular a little bit later on. But let's just, we're using the verbiage we are now. So I got 2 hardware wallets and 2 seed phrases. What are some maybe the best storage principles around securing the devices and the seed phrases, whether you're using, and we could just sort of hypothesize here in general, but you can maybe keep one at home, or maybe you have an office you could use with a safe or a bank with a safety deposit box, or even private storage as the variables here. What are some of the best practices?
That's a deep question, and it's somewhat personal. So what I will say is it's my perspective that multi-sig, which is a native address in Bitcoin. So it's part of the Bitcoin protocol. It's an address that's built with multiple keys. A 2 of 3 address is constructed with 3 keys. 2 out of 3 keys are needed to spend from the Bitcoin. I think multi-sig addresses are what deliver a primary amount of the security, because when set up correctly and when seeds and hardware wallets are stored correctly, you eliminate all single points of failure from the security of your Bitcoin. So yourself, your hardware wallets, your seed words, maybe a partner that you work with. If you work with Unchained, you eliminate Unchained as a single point of failure. And that's when multisig is done correctly. Now, the next question is, you know, how do you secure your hardware wallets and your seed phrases? Well, if they're protecting multisig addresses, none of those things alone are single points of failure. So somebody can have your seed phrase. You can, you know, don't do this at home, but you could tweet your seed phrase out. And if that is one of three seeds protecting an address, somebody who has that information does not have the ability to find your Bitcoin or spend it. So it's not a single point of failure anymore. So when you set up multisig, it really gives you a lot more flexibility and a lot more options. When you're setting up a single signature address, which is a Bitcoin address controlled by one key, you can think of it as a one of one address versus multisig, which is maybe like a two of three address. Then the seed, the 12 or 24 words that you write down, that is a critical point of failure. So if it's discovered, then somebody has your Bitcoin. That's the primary difference, I would say, between single signature and multisig, is that multisig eliminates single points of failure when done correctly. Okay, so with that kind of foundation, the next question is, what do I do with the items that I'm securing? So in Unchained Capital's two of three collaborative custody multisig, where Unchained holds a key, you have two keys. What you have to protect are four physical items, two hardware wallets, two seed phrases. At a bare minimum, what you need to do is take one of those seed phrases and separate it from the other three items. Because if even one of those items is left over, Unchained can help you recover your funds. So we can step in and, you know, sign a transaction. If you just have one seed phrase or one hardware wallet, so you can lose three out of four of those items without losing funds. Now, a secondary benefit of multisig is that even if somebody has both of your seeds, right, two out of four items, they still don't have the ability to find your Bitcoin. They can spend your Bitcoin if they have the directions to find your Bitcoin, but they also need the directions to your Bitcoin. So I kind of call it like a treasure map. You need to have a treasure map, and then they need to have keys to open the treasure chest. So bare minimum, one of those items should be geographically separated. And what that means is kind of different to each person. Yeah. Some people like to stamp those into steel, maybe put one seed in a safety deposit box. You can give a seed, a multi-sig seed, to a trusted relative, because again, that person with one seed cannot find your multi-sig Bitcoin. And even if they could find it, they wouldn't be able to spend it with one key. So you have a lot more flexibility with where you store those, because each item is less critical. It's still the most important thing that you're protecting is your seed phrase, but by itself, it's essentially meaningless. So a little bit of a roundabout answer, but hopefully that kind of touches on it. I would say good places to secure things are maybe a safety deposit box for one of the seeds at Bank A, maybe an office safe for another item, a home safe for an item, a trusted relative, trusted friend. Other people will, you know, bury a metal seed. I'm not necessarily recommending that, but you have a lot of options that you can do once you have multi-sig. Now with single signature, I think it changes it significantly. You have to be a lot more careful about the seed. You have to be a lot more careful about your passphrase. If you're using a passphrase, that's another single point of failure. So if you're just trying to memorize a passphrase and you forget which letter you capitalized, you're not holding your key anymore. So be careful with single signature seeds. And then if you add a passphrase, just make sure that the passphrase is also secured well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. And this gives a lot of different optionality to what we can do with Bitcoin. So what else is Unchained working on besides just helping me secure my Bitcoin?
So security is really the foundation of our platform. It's the introduction. Us teaching you how to hold your keys, that's the start of the relationship. And multi-sig is really what we build our whole platform on top of. So beyond that, beyond just making sure that our clients do not lose their Bitcoin, which we think is, you know, a top priority, it's a critical priority. If people lose Bitcoin, it's not going to be valuable. It's not going to be the world's currency. You have to be able to secure it relatively easily in order to then have it become the global reserve currency. So once we get it secure in a vault, then we have a bunch of different financial products that we can offer. So we are a financial services company. So you can purchase Bitcoin through us, through our trading desk. You can sell Bitcoin through a trading desk. We do have kind of high minimums at this point. So it's $50,000 minimums through our trading desk. But it is really cool because it goes directly into your vault. So you're not making large, scary Bitcoin transactions. We have our Bitcoin collateralized loans. So if you want to access some liquidity from your Bitcoin, some dollars without selling your Bitcoin, if you think it's, you know, going to go up over the next few months, you can collateralize it, take out some dollars, pay off your fiat expenses, and then make interest only payments for the duration of the loan. It's risky, you know, like with anything in Bitcoin, just be careful and stay humble, stay conservative, but it can be a very powerful tool. If you're doing like a home renovation or need to buy a new car, something like that, and you're off, you've gotten on zero US dollars. It's a valuable tool in your toolkit. And then go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're about to get to it. I'm super excited for what Jeff Andrews is working on over there.
Yes, sir. So very recently, we brought on Jeff as our head of retirement and inheritance. And we're very pleased to offer our Bitcoin, our Unchained Bitcoin IRA product. So what I really like about this is that a majority of the wealth in the US is trapped currently in these zombie retirement accounts. So these retirement accounts are yielding on average 5 to 8% per year. And what was inflation last month? 7%, right? You know, 7%.
Right.
It was more realistically 20 or 30% or, you know, it depends on what you want to buy.
Right.
But the official numbers were 7. So if your retirement account is yielding 5, you're losing value. And $35 trillion worth of value are currently trapped in these retirement accounts. So what the Unchained IRA allows you to do is if you have an old 401k or an old IRA, or you just want to set up a new IRA, from one place, you can set up the IRA, you can convert your old retirement accounts as much or as little as you'd like into Bitcoin. We do have a $6,000 minimum for the IRA, but beyond that, as much or as little as you would like. And we deposit it into a vault where you have 2 out of 3 keys. So you have key control. And we're able to do this by working with our partner. So the way that IRAs work, there's a lot of legalese that we can go into, and Jeff is definitely more of an expert on it than I am. But we partner with an IRA custodian that essentially owns your IRA, and they delegate key control to you and to Unchained. So you have real Bitcoin where you're holding 2 out of 3 private keys to a multi-signature address. You know, basically fill out an order form, go through our profile approval. If you have a vault with us, you can use the same hardware wallets that you've already been using. And we just build a new vault in a new kind of legal context, the IRA context. And you can start rolling over your whatever kind of IRA or 401k funds you would like. Just send it, transfer it normally.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I think there's just a lot of what you want to call it, liquidity or wealth or value just trapped in those. I like the way you put it to those zombie sort of systems. I mean, it really is zombie shopping. You're just buying every week or every month or every 2 weeks, whatever's on order, whatever they got to rebalance to, whatever the valuation or price is, with no respect to do like long-term value or anything like that. And they're rebalancing you out of the winners and putting you into the losers. So it's just a lot of cutting your flowers and watering your weeds. It's a very powerful tool.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think about Bitcoin as, you know, it's a perfect savings vehicle because the supply is totally immutable. There's 21 million, there will never be more. And that's kind of the selling point. The main selling point of Bitcoin is that it's never going to be debased and you can send it and receive it to anyone in the world as long as you hold the keys. So it's a perfect long-term or passive savings vehicle. If you just want to lock away some value for multiple years, what's better? You know, people treat their 401ks as savings, but what they're actually doing is investing. It's very different. And actually, Parker Lewis wrote a great article called Bitcoin is the Great Definancialization, where he breaks down the differences between investing versus saving. Highly recommend a read, but we've all been trained to save for retirement, but what we're actually doing is investing. When we have a 401k, when we have an IRA, it's going into index fund, all the, you know, all kinds of weird stuff. So with Bitcoin, you can actually save for retirement. You just lock up the value in BTC. You have some sats, got your keys. It's in multi-sig, so you don't have any single points of failure. And you go about your day.
Yeah. What's really great too, is you could do it on both sides of the fence with both the Roth and the regular 401k. So you could do it with pre or post-tax dollars. It's an incredible way to plan for the future. One other way to tie into multi-sig technology is somehow you got drawn into the bet with American HODL and Peter McCormack.
Yes.
What happened there? How'd you get involved? And did you ever have to sign any transactions?
So we actually did two podcasts. How did we get involved? I think it was just over a Twitter debate about the 2020 election. So Peter McCormack wanted to make a bet about Biden winning the election. I think American HODL took Trump winning the election, and they wanted to put some Bitcoin up for a bet. And we decided to use Unchained's open source tool, Caravan, to secure the funds. So Caravan is a tool that is provided, you know, free of service. It's open source. It's available to the community. You can check it out at caravanmultisig.com. And it allows you to, first and foremost, recover from an Unchained vault in about 30 seconds if anything goes wrong with Unchained. So if you can't access your Unchained vault for any reason or your Unchained account, you can just take your recovery file, which I mentioned earlier as your kind of treasure map, take your treasure map, load it into Caravan, sign your transaction with your keys, and you're off. And the whole recovery process literally takes 30 seconds if you have all your items. But what's also cool about Caravan is you can construct multi-sig addresses collaboratively. So because it's just essentially a website, we were able to build a 2 of 3 multi-sig address where I contributed one piece, Peter McCormack contributed another piece, American HODL contributed the third piece. And these are public keys that we're contributing. I think of public keys as locks. If private keys are keys, public keys are locks. Bitcoin addresses can have one lock or they can have multiple locks. But we built an address with three public keys that we just shared from our hardware wallets over the internet, and they locked up some money for a bet. So I that was the first test. And then the second one was after the election, where Biden won. And so we all got back together and I helped them spend the funds. So Peter wasn't paying the best of attention during the setup, and he ended up losing the recovery file. If you remember the treasure map that I was talking about, he lost the map. So he had a key, but he didn't know where he could use the key. But luckily he had me there and he had American HODL there, and both of us remembered all of the different components. And so we were able to very easily find the address and spend the Bitcoin.
Yeah. He's lucky HODL honored the bet because he didn't have the key if HODL wanted to walk away from that one.
Well, so Peter had a key, but he didn't have the directions to the address. I had the directions to the address and I had a key and I was the arbiter. So, you know, maybe American HODL and I at BitBlock Boom 1 year might have talked about what it would be like to just take Peter's money, but I'm an honest, honest guy. And so I wanted to make sure that the money got back to the rightful owner. We were able to just do that collaboratively over the internet without ever meeting in person. I think, I was in Texas, Peter McCormack was in Bedford, And I think American HODL lives on the internet somewhere. Mm-hmm. So wherever American HODL was, we were all just able to sign the transaction and move the funds without ever meeting in person. So that's the power of Caravan, which again is just our open source tool that we published. So it's a really cool tool. And if you're interested in just learning about multi-sig, definitely a fun tool to play around with. It's very simple. Go to the website, start connecting hardware wallets. There's your addresses.
Yeah. That's really interesting and an awesome story. But we used some words there. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of misnomers in Bitcoin. I think you kind of helped dispel those. You wrote a great piece, All 21 Million Bitcoin Already Exists, that we're going to get into. To quote you, to celebrate the 600,000th Bitcoin block, which has unlocked the 18th millionth Bitcoin, and in an effort to become increasingly fun to be around at parties, you wrote this piece exploring the idea that all 21 million Bitcoin already exists. But you kind of start out with, like, we have these misnomers around like wallets and addresses. And what really, how would you describe those things or dispel the way we think of them?
Sure. Those are really hard questions. We use wallet just to mean all kinds of different things in Bitcoin. So a hardware wallet, that's more of like a key factory or a key store. It holds your keys and it can hold nearly infinite keys. It's like a key factory. It generates as many keys as you need. A wallet, the way that I think about wallets, I think of wallets as a series of addresses. And you can have wallet software that gives you directions to your addresses. So if we're thinking about like Trezor, the hardware wallet or device is your key store. The device shares public information with Trezor Suite, which is your wallet coordinator. It coordinates all your addresses for you to construct your wallet. So there's a great visualization that I put together back in the day where it just has these things broken out. There's basically a key store. There's a wallet or address coordinator, so some sort of software, and then it gets consensus from the blockchain. There's a bunch of different components that come into play when talking about a wallet. I got a little bit off track there, I think, but basically, I don't think of hardware wallets as wallets. I think of those as my keys. I think of Electrum as my wallet software, and it gathers information from the blockchain and it gathers information from my devices and it displays my wallet, which is a series of addresses. So wallets are a series of addresses. They're constructed through a lot of different moving parts. And that's what I'm going with there. Now, addresses are funny because, you know, I think it's an okay word, but it's not like an email address. You know, you don't want to send Bitcoin to the same address repeatedly necessarily if you care about your long-term privacy. You don't want to repeatedly visit the same address because then all of those transactions can be tracked and kind of, you know, there's assumptions that can be made about, you know, who owns it. That's how all of those Twitter bots and articles know, you know, how many Bitcoin Coinbase has, for example, because they reuse addresses. So it's pretty easy to be like, oh, there's Coinbase's address. So addresses are not places you want to repeatedly visit, unlike a home address where you go back to the same address. But addresses is kind of an okay term. It's hard to think of something that's better. But yeah. I think this article, All 21 Million Bitcoin Already Exists, digs into this term mining. Because mining, I think, is a pretty incorrect term in a lot of ways. And it leads you to believe that what miners are doing is creating new coins. But it's no secret that Bitcoin's monetary policy is 21 million. Like, everybody knows, not everybody, but as soon as you dig like one layer deep into what Bitcoin is, you hear about 21 million, right? So we should all stop pretending that this 21 million is like, oh, maybe it's adjustable. It's not. And the way that I get to that is by talking about how it's my perspective that they all exist, and what miners, you know, the people we call miners today, what they're really doing is they're processing transactions. by selling electricity to the network. And so the Bitcoin network is purchasing a ton of electricity because that is what helps it process transactions, add blocks to the blockchain. So I don't have a better name for miners, but that's kind of the basis of this article. Is I think it's much easier to think about all the Bitcoin as just being there and they're unlocked on a fixed schedule. And in fact, you know, we know a lot more about the upcoming blocks reward than we know about, you know, how much money people are going to be sending around at a given day. Satoshi could just dump his 1 million coins tomorrow and we would have no idea. But we do know that tomorrow, 6.25 Bitcoin are released every 10 minutes or unlocked every 10 minutes. So yeah, I just kind of talk about how that's selling electricity to the network for mining is just another form of transacting. And if you're looking to set up, start mining, that's great. I wouldn't say that you're creating Bitcoin. You're helping to process Bitcoin. You're rewarded those locked Bitcoin. And then you get all the tips. So there's another article that I write about that I wrote after that one called 21 million is non-negotiable, which goes a little bit more into the security budget, because you hear a lot of altcoin marketers talking about how, well, Bitcoin's long-term security is debatable because they're using a risky model where they can't change and all this kind of BS. And the second article, it goes into more details about how, you know, none of the models that they're producing are based on good assumptions. They're all based on faulty assumptions. They're all measured in a currency that isn't Bitcoin. The Bitcoin network doesn't rely on other currencies existing to function. It relies on electricity and people holding keys and using keys to send transactions. And it relies on the difficulty adjustment to make sure that it's always profitable for somebody out there to process transactions as long as people want to send transactions. So we would already have seen major security issues if it was ever going to be an issue, because, you know, the 21 million supply would be, you know, would have been a problem beforehand. But in reality, the 21 million supply is what makes it valuable. It's the thing that is the whole reason we're here. So Bitcoin is its 21 million supply in my mind.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and I'd love to dig deeper. So like when we talk about the 21 million Bitcoin, I guess you're contending, and I really like this way of framing it, is that it's always exists, that we had this big bang moment with the first transaction, and 21 million Bitcoin is always there. So one, does that mean that the halvings and the future supply schedule are already priced in?
No, absolutely not. So information is asymmetric, right? You and I know that 21 million Bitcoin, it's already exists, or, you know, there's a schedule and it's released this way. And you and I understand kind of what that means, but the broader population doesn't know anything about money. So they don't really know what's going on with Bitcoin. They know it's speculative. They're diving into JPEGs and, you know, ICOs or whatever. And they think it's this new industry, when reality, the reality is that money has changed. The whole world is now on a new monetary system, and it's 21 million. And so that information is just hasn't dispersed yet. Now, a lot of those models out there will kind of, you know, say that the halvings are, you know, help to increase the price of Bitcoin. But I just think it's, you're trying to measure demand, right? The supply of Bitcoin is a vertical line. Mm-hmm. It's never changing. And what changes constantly is people's demand for Bitcoin. And that'll never change. It'll always change in value slightly based on how much people are demanding a currency, because a currency is just like any other, well, not just like any other good, but just like any other good, it does change in value depending on demand. So there's like the law of supply and demand, and that's kind of universal, I would say. It applies to currencies, it applies to tickets, it applies to computers.
Right. Yeah. Do you think it's possible for a computer program to HODL Bitcoin?
So I think the Bitcoin network HODLs the rest of the Bitcoin. But the Bitcoin network, it's kind of weird. It's like, what is the network? Well, it's code, yes. but it's also people, because without people holding keys and sending transactions and mining and running nodes, then the code doesn't really do anything. So Bitcoin is the marriage of social consensus and technical consensus. You can't have one without the other. So it's kind of both. But what I do think about is the value of the remaining supply of Bitcoin is currently being held by all holders of the currency. So when 6.25 Bitcoin gets released every 10 minutes, you know, the reason that that 6.25 Bitcoin has value is because I save in Bitcoin, you know, you save in Bitcoin, and it's some of our value that's going towards bootstrapping the currency. So I think of the supply schedule as the bootstrapping phase. And once that's done, and the cost, the security cost is socialized. It's a very socialist system, unfortunately. Yeah. But once, you know, we're being charged, our value is being absorbed through this this subsidy. But once the subsidy shifts and it's more a transaction-based model, then only the people who are sending transactions are paying. And I think that's actually a much more fair system.
Yeah, maybe you could outline how on the bootstrapping part of the system is where we're in this sort of public indirect subsidization of the security of the network versus when we move past 2140 and it's just on transaction fees, how that's a more private direct cost. Maybe you could outline that. It's a very interesting way to think about it.
Sure. So right now, you know, I think Bitcoin's extreme, the value is extremely volatile, and there's many reasons why, right? Information is asymmetric. A lot of us believe that Bitcoin is the currency of the future. It's going to be the global reserve currency and so on. Probably more people, actually definitely more people think that, oh, it's a speculative tradable asset and I'm going to trade it for dollars or yen or whatever. And they're living in a dollar or yen based world. So I think the first kind of 4 years of Bitcoin were even more volatile, and that's because 50 Bitcoin were being released every 10 minutes. And so the supply of available currency was just was unlocking at a very rapid pace. And so more people were able to sell it and move it around. Now it's actually significantly less volatile than it used to be because of the size. It's getting much bigger. I forgot what the original question was, though. That's my train of thought.
I kind of lost my train of thought there too. I think it was around whether, around just trying to frame up the private versus the public cost of it and the direct versus the indirect. Cause I just never really thought about how I was indirectly supporting the system through
you have to look at the value of the total value of the network, right? The whole network is worth X trillion dollars, and your fraction of it is what is, you know, is the portion of what is unlocked right now. But more units are being unlocked, and the value is being kind of moved from the holders to the miners, mm-hmm. or the people who are unlocking them. And it's kind of a messy sort of, it's not, you know, just binary there, because a lot of newcomers are purchasing their first Bitcoin and injecting more value into the network overall. But I will say that, yeah, the security budget is paid for by everybody who's holding Bitcoin because of that subsidy. It doesn't really matter how many units there are in the currency. There could be, you know, 42 million units, and this would hold true as well. So it's just that because there's that budget, the value is kind of moved more towards mining. Although it's so funny, like in the second article, I talk about how mining is actually becoming a significantly smaller portion of the overall Bitcoin economy. But at the same time, in US dollar terms, like last year was the largest year for miner revenue ever. It was like $12 billion or something. When I wrote the second article in 2019, the security budget was like $500 million. And there were 12 and a half Bitcoin being released every 10 minutes. Now, with 6.25 Bitcoin released every 10 minutes, the security budget was $12 billion, right? So it's not the nominal amount of Bitcoin, it's the value overall of the network, and it's the demand of the electricity. So
yeah,
there's a lot of concepts in there.
Yeah. And I want to quote you from your article to kind of outline this a little further. The Bitcoin network itself is its 21 million supply. The supply is a vertical line in the supply and demand model, meaning it's completely inelastic. This limit is written into the code that all full node operators choose to run. And more importantly, it's the limit we all agree to when we purchase our first Bitcoin. It has nearly unanimous social consensus. In Bitcoin's history, there have already been multiple technical inflation bugs discovered and one inflation bug exploited. But the network ultimately viewed those transactions as an invalid minority hard fork and maintained the socially understood supply schedule, even though it required node operators to run patched software. It's reasonable to expect we will see more software bugs like this in the future. And once again, the network will have to rely on social consensus. Luckily, the network's incentives are all designed around socially and technically maintaining this 21 million limit. This really struck me. One, it reminded me of my show with Phil Champagne around the Book of Satoshi and running into these inflation bugs and the urgency around fixing them. And what stuck out to me here was just around the social consensus around what we touched on in the beginning of the show is that where it meets the technical consensus. And you even intimate that it could happen again in the future. And that it's all about the 21 million limit. And I really do believe that. It's really what I think strikes me the most about Bitcoin is the monetary policy more than anything else. And it's irrelevant what the number would be if it was 19 million or 27 million or 270 million, whatever it is, or one. But the fact that it's sort of set in stone. And I think what this article really illuminates is that everyone who buys Bitcoin buys it with that in mind, that limit in mind. I think that's really important. And so I kind of want to talk a little bit about or go back to your point, though, is like, so when you talk about mining and we, you know, I like the idea, too, where it's about selling electricity to the network. And what that illuminates to me is maybe you could talk a little bit more about how miners don't create new supply.
Sure. And maybe to touch on the previous point just a little bit, I think the social consensus aspect of Bitcoin is really, really interesting. And the best demonstration of that, in my mind, is the Bitcoin Cash fork, right? Because in the mind of the Bitcoin Cash holders, Bitcoin was supposed to have infinite block sizes, or the block size is supposed to be gigamegs or whatever. And they thought that was Bitcoin. And so they think that what consensus views as Bitcoin is a minority hard fork. So the network split, right? And we know the history, like Bitcoin Cash is dead for all intents and purposes. It's essentially worthless. Bitcoin has seen new all-time highs. So the same thing could happen. And I view, that's what I would view an inflation bug as. If an inflation bug started happening, that's not what I signed up for. So I would just run code that maintained the limit. I signed up for the 21 million limit. And because I run a full node, I can do that. I get to choose that. And what I would also do is I would have then two currencies, right? So just like Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, I would have Bitcoin and Bitcoin inflation. And I would run the Bitcoin software that upholds the 21 million limit. And then I would take Bitcoin inflation and I would sell it for Bitcoin. And through that action, maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of my understanding of Bitcoin, 21 million. So that's what I would do. And that's what happened with Bitcoin Cash. We were all given keys to two different networks, and a vast majority of Bitcoin Cash holders that were Bitcoiners sold their BCH for whatever, any other currency. I sold mine for more Bitcoin. Because in my mind, Bitcoin is the 21 million hard cap. It's the limited block sizes, because the limited block sizes help to increase in decentralization. So you need to have both of those things. So yeah, I would just assume that there's going to be a horrible bug in the future. Like, obviously, I hope that that doesn't happen, but just be ready for it. If there's a bug, just run the software that follows the social consensus that you understand. What I understand is 21 million and the limited block size.
Yeah.
Now, to the other question, it was about miners and how they don't, how they're actually selling electricity to the network and not actually creating coins. It's been really interesting to see the Houston Bitcoin meetup. So if you ever have an opportunity, you should come to the Houston Bitcoin meetup. It happens once a month. And there's a lot of energy people in the room. And it's because Bitcoin mining is, in my view, not even its own industry. It's actually a component of the energy production industry. It is a way to vent excess electricity. Anything that you're not going to be able to sell at a higher price, you mine Bitcoin with it. This allows you to build as much, you know, capacity as you would like, produce as much electricity as you would like, and you'll always have a buyer of electricity in the Bitcoin network. You can dump as much electricity into the network as you would like, and you will be paid market rate for that because you know, you're converting it into hashes, you're processing blocks. The block subsidy, which is in new coins, is the coins we already knew were there, but then you also get tips. So you're always going to find a market value for electricity. And this is really interesting. I mean, I think there's been a lot of discussion again. It just comes up every few months. It's like, oh, Bitcoin uses as much energy as Argentina and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, Argentina should really up their energy production game. You know, they should start mining Bitcoin. They should build the Dyson sphere around the sun. And then any excess electricity they have, they can mine Bitcoin with it. That, you know, kind of cheeky, but the point holds. It's that we shouldn't constrain ourselves to the amount of energy that we're producing right now. We should just have an abundance of energy, and then anything that's wasted, you can just dump into the Bitcoin network. And that holds true for any type of energy production. In fact, a very early article I wrote in 20, this one was 2018, I think, was about just that. It was about renewable energy, like wind. They shut off production about 17% of the time because they produce too much electricity and they don't have anyone to sell it to. Mm. And so if you're a big fan of renewable energy, or really what, pick your favorite energy source, look into how often they have to shut it off because they're overproducing. And that's the opportunity for Bitcoin mining right there. And, you know, it is orders and around the world, it's orders and orders and orders of magnitude more energy than the Bitcoin network is using today. So mining is never, like, the Bitcoin security budget will never be an issue until we are perfectly efficient at energy production. Mm-hmm. So if we can always produce the perfect amount of electricity to meet other use cases besides Bitcoin, then Bitcoin might be insecure. But I don't think that's possible. I think you're always going to need a buyer of last resort because things happen, you know, and you might be producing electricity. You don't have anyone to sell it to. You can dump it into Bitcoin. So in my mind, all energy producers will integrate ASICs and mining chips into their facilities, all of them, because it's such a vital aspect of energy production.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of fascinating things there. And, you know, kind of like it really is tangential to your next article that we're going to discuss, which is 21 million is non-negotiable. And if it is non-negotiable, and I bought into 21 million, you know, it kind of, and we've talked about how the network secures itself by buying electricity from the miners, right? The miners aren't creating new supply. They're not creating Bitcoin. They're selling electricity and they receive Bitcoin as their payment for that electricity, and they could either sell that Bitcoin to cover their costs or not, right? And they don't have
They're selling electricity to process transactions for us. That's what we're all paying for.
Right. And they don't even have to sell their electricity to the network. They have free reign there to make a decision whether they could sell it somewhere else for more money. So yeah, that begs the question, will Bitcoin be secure once the block reward subsidy ends?
Yeah, and that's kind of the point that I was talking about before, where as long as energy producers are not perfectly meeting the demand of every other use case besides Bitcoin, So renewable energy is like wind, right? It's variable. Some days there's no wind. Some days there's tons of wind. And demand for energy constantly changes as well. So having something that just buys all of your cheapest electricity allows you to remove the demand side from the equation. Like, you don't have a demand problem anymore. Now it's just produce as much electricity as you can profitably, right? You can sell it at any time to the Bitcoin network. So it's a really, really powerful tool. And that, I don't think that'll ever go away. I don't think humans are going to be able to ever produce the perfect amount of electricity at a given moment to just meet other use cases needs. And so therefore the security, Bitcoin security budget is like not, it's not even an issue. Like right now we waste globally orders of magnitude more energy than the Bitcoin network uses. And instead of wasting that energy, we could be using that to process Bitcoin transactions, so mine Bitcoin, and make our energy producers more efficient and more profitable so that they can find cheaper ways to produce energy. Because we're never going to stop producing energy. So what we should be doing is trying to produce energy as efficiently as possible. And that's good for everybody. It's good for the environment. It's good for me. Prices go down for me. It's good for Bitcoin. It's a win-win-win.
Yeah, I see that. And I, you know, your article also brings up this very interesting point about how, you know, basically, if Bitcoin is alive, keep reading the article. If it's dead, you know, go home. And you kind of define it as Bitcoin is still alive today because some individuals subjectively deem it valuable enough to keep alive. If nobody valued Bitcoin, it would be dead. Whether or not you personally agree that Bitcoin is valuable is irrelevant. Bitcoin is alive because people find it valuable, and there are a number of ways the network is kept alive. Some Bitcoiners keep it alive by using Bitcoin as a savings technology, storing value in it. Some of those individuals run full Bitcoin nodes, meaning that they are verifying that each block of transactions follows the network consensus rules. Others write code that they hope will be run by individuals operating full nodes and storing value in Bitcoin. It's certainly the case that not everyone that stores value in Bitcoin runs a full node or writes code. And it might be the case that node operators and coders don't store value in Bitcoin. They are all contributing to keep Bitcoin alive regardless. Which that kind of begs the question then, how does Bitcoin ensure that selling electricity to the network will always be profitable and productive?
Well, Bitcoin has amazing. So one of Satoshi's greatest inventions or greatest breakthroughs was using what's known as the difficulty adjustment to ensure that blocks on average are found every 10 minutes. So this is pretty incredible. And last year, actually, I think, or was it 2019 or 2020? I don't even know anymore. But when China banned Bitcoin mining, we saw this in action. It was a significant percentage of Bitcoin security, like 40% or something crazy, was just shut off. And let's look around. Is Bitcoin still here? Is it still secure? Yeah. Like in a given day, 40% of the miners, of the people contributing or selling electricity, can just shut off selling electricity to the network. And the network's going to be okay because the difficulty adjustment, so blocks might be found a little bit slower, maybe 12 minutes, 15 minutes on average for a period of time, 2016 blocks. But after that, the difficulty adjustment will look at that amount of time and say, oh, I was off by 10%. So let's reduce the difficulty of mining by 10% so that the next 2 weeks of worth of blocks are found every 10 minutes. So this is how Bitcoin can weather extreme shocks to its mining and to its security. And it's fine because we have the difficulty adjustment. The difficulty adjustment kicks in. Blocks are going to be maybe slower or faster for a period of time. I think on average for Bitcoin's history, blocks have actually been found a little bit faster than 10 minutes. It's like 8 or 9 minutes, something like that, because there's so much demand, right? And so the difficulty adjustment can't even keep up with the amount of security. But because we have the difficulty adjustment, we don't have to worry about it. Like as long as people value Bitcoin and are sending Bitcoin transactions, there's really a few things to key in on. Do people still value it? Do they still send transactions? If those two things are true, the difficulty adjustment and security budget are going to take care of itself. I mean, if people stop valuing Bitcoin and everybody just, you know, stops caring about sound money and a money that can't be debased, then it doesn't matter if Bitcoin doesn't have a security budget because we don't care about it, right? Mm-hmm. But as long as it matters, as long as we're saving and storing value and demanding electricity, demanding 10-minute block times, the difficulty adjustment makes sure that Bitcoin will always be secure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really great way to put it. And it's such a clever way that Satoshi solved that issue and such an invention for humanity, actually. But, you know, I mean, with the way things are going, with no rally in sight, shouldn't Bitcoin consider loosening the monetary policy? You know?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. Shouldn't the monetary policy governors do something? Bitcoin, you know, as Nick Carter says, bites the bullet. Bitcoin takes the hard route. We trade short-term volatility for long-term stability and security. And this is personal, you know, if you feel like, you know what, I can't weather the storm anymore, sell your Bitcoin. You can convert it into any currency in the world. You can convert it into JPEGs and all kinds of crazy stuff. And there's going to be somebody out there who's willing to take your Bitcoin off of your hands for you, as someone with maybe a little bit stronger hands than yours.
Yeah.
there's no, you know, the monetary policy governors is 21 million. Like that's it. That's the monetary policy. There's nobody, you can go scream, you know, out into the wind that you wish that it was different, and it's just not going to happen because there's too many crazies out there that are demanding 21 million.
Yeah. I like the way you put it. First you wrote, no number go bigger equal everybody go bigger happy. Might be a phrase uttered by an altcoin marketer, Nobel Prize winning economist, Paul Krugman, or president of a Federal Reserve branch. You also went on to write, unfortunately, introducing monetary inflation can't make anybody bigger happy. Be bigger than happy, except for those with the power to print currency in their closest friends, thanks to the Cantillon effect. The Cantillon effect describes how the knowledge of a currency's debasement spreads throughout society unequally, granting an advantage to those with the power to print money and causing economic hardships for those furthest away from the printers. Currency is non-productive. It isn't a company. Having more total supply just means that each individual unit is worth less, and value is transferred from those who hold the currency to those who create more units and distribute them before the rest of the population understands that their savings have been debased. So where does a currency's utility come from?
So in my mind, you know, so money solves the age-old problem of the double coincidence of wants. If I produce apples and you produce cows and we want to make a trade, but we don't necessarily want what each other produces, we can use a token. We can use money to facilitate that trade. And money is just a tool. It's a tool to store and communicate value. And just like with any tool that humans have created or discovered or invented, there are different properties that make it better or worse at its job. Some of the biggest properties are scarcity, transferability, divisibility, fungibility. There's a few others. But Bitcoin is really the best tool for the job because it is, you know, utterly fixed in supply. You can divide it into, you know, 8 decimal points. You can send it over the internet to anyone in the world instantly with the Lightning Network. It's essentially free. If you want to make large purchases, you send it on layer one, and it's very, very cheap, very inexpensive. It's the best form of money. So money solves an absolutely critical problem. We're never going to get rid of money. It is a tool that is so fundamental to civilization. It is essentially, in my mind, the tool that allowed us to create civilization. It coordinates all economic activity and across the world. So it's so fundamental and so critical that we get it right, that it'll always be there. So I was being cheeky with the kind of dumb quote, you know, number go bigger, make me bigger happy. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just, if you look at the Federal Reserve's policy of the last 2 years, like this, that's it. Like print more money, $7 trillion. I don't know, try $15 trillion, try $30 trillion. Like, it doesn't matter. It's dumb. Like, when you print money, like because money is the thing that allows us to store and communicate value, if you print more of it, you disrupt its ability to store or communicate value. And then the people who have just printed it, like out there and looking up, you know, how much money the Fed is printing every week or every month, it's a ton still. So they're able to just allocate those dollars before the rest of the population understands that their money is broken. And how do you know that your money is broken? When you start hearing things about the supply chain, when you start seeing, oh, there's a shortage of chicken wings. There's a chicken wing shortage here in Austin. It was pretty tragic. But things stop, like money stops functioning to be able to coordinate economic activity. You know, people can't find workers. There's like restaurants out there that are like, we're hiring, we're giving $1,000 bonuses, right? There's labor shortages. This is all textbook currency problems. Look up any currency collapse in the last 100, multiple hundred years, 200 years, all the same signs. So that's my little rant about inflation and altcoins. Like, changing the supply of your currency does not make it more secure, because if you look at any of the altcoins, they're not as secure as Bitcoin. Right? Like we need to have flexible monetary policies so that we can make sure that it's always secure. It's like, okay, well, why is your shitcoin insecure today?
Yeah.
Because the monetary policy sucks.
It's great questions. And it just shows how important the monetary policy is to security. I'm going to read your words back to you before I have my final couple questions for you.
Sure.
Adding inflation would destroy the value proposition of Bitcoin altogether by proving yet again that it's trivial to print currency and create copies of things that are digital. Look at every other currency. Digital scarcity is a one-time phenomenon. The best protection Bitcoin has against all other currencies is its unyielding monetary policy, which is enforced socially and technically by every individual that stores value in Bitcoin. There will likely be inflation bugs, hard forks, new currencies printed throughout the marathon of Bitcoin's ascendance. Social consensus will kick in during these times to ensure the 21 million policy remains intact. This process transfers wealth from those who do not understand economics to those who do. Adding units of currency does not create value, it merely transfers it. I'm personally optimistic that the process of transferring wealth from those who don't understand these concepts to those who do will lead to positive outcomes for humanity in the future. It's easy to create as many units of another currency as you'd like. In Bitcoin, 21 million is non-negotiable. So my final two questions for you is, one, I mean, being in Bitcoin so long, kind of understanding Austrian economics and, you know, the 100-year history of money, and, you know, we can see what's happening today. I mean, how frustrated are you maybe with, you know, the common man, or just, you know, people outside of Bitcoin? You seem like someone who's very tempered, you know, very well, like not doesn't maybe get angry or something. I don't know. Like, how does this make you feel watching this happen in slow motion, or living in the future while everyone's in the present?
That's a good question. I think I'm short-term pessimistic, long-term extremely optimistic, right? I believe that things are going to get worse for the next few years, and then they're going to get a lot better. Like, within my lifetime, things are going to be significantly more prosperous. But yeah, I think we're going to go through a hard time. I think the hard time is inevitable. It's the best metaphor I've heard is, you know, a heroin junkie trying to get clean, right? You can't get clean without going through a horrible withdrawal. So my strategy has just always been my friends, my family, my community. I want them to adopt Bitcoin before other people. So, you know, I've onboarded hundreds of people to holding keys. It's my kind of my day job, right? So I just try to get as many private keys into the hands of as many people as possible. And yeah, I think long-term, you know, I try to stay optimistic. I think a lot of the people, they're so wrapped up in the narrative and the propaganda that it's hard for them to kind of let go and be like, oh, wait a minute. Things actually are not the way that that my, you know, media is telling me that it is. Or I just think of, you know, the official narrative is just so far detached from the reality that I see at this point that it's kind of funny. But I think it's just, you know, keeping your head down, staying humble, being in it for the long run. Like, you know, I'm gonna be here for I'll be in Bitcoin for the rest of my life. Like, I'm never leaving the Bitcoin standard. And it's just waiting for people to play catch up, and they'll get there. I mean, they already are. If I think about, you know, how long it's taken some of my relatives to get on board, it's been kind of funny, but they're on board, right? It's like, hey, it took you 5 years. That's fine. You're here. You bought in at 60K. Yeah. Welcome. Bitcoin is, I had a tweet the other day. Like, the holding Bitcoin is the feeling of being woken up by being punched in the stomach like every day for years until you're just more prosperous.
That's awesome.
So welcome to the show. You know, it's mm-hmm. great. Like, it's so weird, and it's so cool that we are alive for something like this happening. Like, how random is that? A monetization event, you know, brought to us by the internet. It's crazy. So I'm along for the ride. I like to just, I've become a much lighter shill over time. I was much more aggressive earlier on. All of those friends are now very happy with me, but you know, now it's like, yeah, if people bring it up, I'm happy, of course, always to talk about it. But I think what I can do at Unchained is focus my time on the people who are ready, willing, want to take control of keys. Like, to me, that's the biggest impact that I can have, is just spending time with people, getting them set up, helping them to feel secure, learn about the tools. And that's how we win. Like, one person at a time. It's going to be a grind for another 5 to 7 years. It's called the eternal September, right? Where it's a new technology. And for the first decades or so, people are going to be asking the same questions. And so we just got to put our heads down and just work through it. But it's happening. I mean, yeah. We already have a country that's adopted Bitcoin. Like, the writing's on the wall, team.
I hear you. Yeah. I definitely share a lot of your opinions there. My final question then is around a little more optimistic note. And what is this Dyson sphere that we're going to use to mine the Bitcoin? And is that going to happen in our lifetimes?
No, so that's just a joke. The Dyson sphere is it's a sci-fi concept where you build energy harvesting technology or a sphere around your star, around your sun, to just collect as much energy as possible. And it doesn't actually work with Bitcoin because the sun's too far away to be able to ever win blocks. But the sentiment is really what I find funny, which is that people are like, oh, you know, Bitcoin's bad for the environment, like all these, you know, energy sources. And I'm like, no, pedal the metal. Like, we're going to harvest so much energy that your mind is going to melt. And we're going to use it to mine Bitcoin. And we're going to use it to improve people's lives, because people's lives are improved through an abundance of energy. It's always been true. Like, let's harness as much energy as we can, as efficiently as possible, which is what Bitcoin allows us to do. It allows us to be super efficient with our energy production. And that just brings more prosperity to people. So I'm just kind of, you know, being a bit of a shit poster when I say build the Dyson sphere. But whenever I see like, oh, Bitcoin uses more energy than Argentina, it's like, man, Argentina needs to step up their game. Mm-hmm. Like, they need to be building nuclear reactors and, you know, decommissioning, you know, old nuclear subs to grab the energy and mine Bitcoin. Like, we want to be producing as much energy as possible, as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's so awesome. Thank you so much, Phil. This has been so dope. I've enjoyed this tremendously. I'll definitely leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you.
Sure. Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at Phil_Geiger. You're welcome to email me. I'm Phil@Unchained.com. And come check us out at Unchained. I mean, I think we're building the first financial services company using Bitcoin's native tools. So we really respect this idea of private key ownership, and we're able to construct a lot of the similar financial products that you might be used to, you know, buying and selling Bitcoin, loans, IRAs. We have a lot coming down the pipeline as well. All starting from this foundation of you're not going to lose your Bitcoin if you're using multi-sig and you're holding your own keys. You know, you read all about all those hacks on all these exchanges, people losing Bitcoin all the time, forgetting their passwords, stuff like that. You know, multi-sig is slightly more complicated. There's a few more moving parts. It's not terrible. Once you get up and running, you send a few transactions and get comfortable with it, it's a very robust way to secure Bitcoin. You're not going to lose your Bitcoin. So come check us out. We'll walk you through the whole process. My team in particular walks people through setting up hardware wallets, holding your own keys, moving funds from Coinbase or an exchange or wherever. We're happy to help you move it into your own control. And so we focus a lot on security, education, and then long-term financial products, because we view our clients as multi-generational clients. We're here for the long term.
Yeah, Bitcoin is generational wealth, and can't really do that without multi-generation. So
that's right.
Yeah, man, this has been so dope. Thank you so much, Phil.
Yeah, Cedric, thanks for having me.
Phil Geiger on how 21 million Bitcoin is non-negotiable right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. This episode was brought to you by Citadel Cabins, CypherSafe, Ledin, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. If you take your Bitcoin security seriously, go that extra step and secure it from physical disaster with a CypherWheel seed storage device. Go to CypherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX for 10% off your order to keep your sats safe. Citadel Cabins exists to help individuals achieve shelter, rest, security, and location independence. Head over to CitadelCabins.com and fill out an application. Ledin.io is a secure, easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. If you want to see what it's all about, get $50 in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan. Head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Bitcoin 2022 is the largest Bitcoin event in the world that takes place April 6th to 9th in Miami Beach. All 4 days will be jam-packed with exclusive content, exciting announcements, and an incredible lineup of Bitcoin speakers. Make sure to use the code Bitcoin Matrix at checkout to get 10% off, and I will see you in Miami. And thank you for listening. Stack stats, stay humble, and stay laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.